so my name is Tim Jones, and I'm conducting this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust and the One Another Project in Trafalgar Square, London. It's the 9th of October.
8th.
8th of October, 2009, and the time is 6:15 in the morning. Can you please tell me your name, your age, and where you come from?
Hi, I'm Shane Enright. I'm 49 years old, and I'm a very proud Londoner.
Okay, great. When was it you first found out about the One Another Project?
Even before it was conceived, when it was one of the shortlisted projects for the Fourth Plinth. I've been a great admirer of the Fourth Plinth as an idea, and I've actually been following Anthony Gormley's work for many years. I wrote about a piece of his called Feel for the British Isles back in 1994, and that was another participative project where young people and school kids were invited to help create figurines out of clay, which then became a field of figures looking back at the audience and at the viewer. And I thought that was a very exciting idea, but nothing beats this. So I registered literally, the day the website opened.
And how did you feel when you received the email or the telephone call to say that you'd been allocated your slot?
Hooray! I mean, I'm just over the moon, really. It's a wonderful project. It's fantastic idea. It's brilliant to be in the audience and that there's something happening all the time. But to actually have the privilege to be a contributor, that's something special. So after we've finished today, I'm going to go back into the office and I'm going to wear my One and Other t-shirt and I'm going to get a few pats on the back, I think, from my colleagues.
Great. What have you decided to do for the hour?
Well, the really special thing about the plinth is that it's an opportunity for people to be themselves and to express themselves. And those are two fundamental freedoms that are denied to many people around the world. In fact, there are very many countries around the world where a project of this nature simply would not be able to be realized or would put those people who participated in danger or at risk. So I want to use my hour on the plinth, expressing myself, being myself, but in doing so, bringing to mind those people that don't have these two fundamental cherished freedoms. So I'm going to spend the hour talking about what Amnesty International does to defend freedom of expression, to defend fundamental human rights. And I'm just going to run through a series of placards that I've got that describe various of our campaigns. And in fact, when I knew I was going to come on the plinth, which was a very short notice, I ran around the office and I said, who's doing what? What are we doing now? What have we got that represents our activism? Our placards are about public demonstrations or about public expressions of our concerns. And I've gathered 16, 17 of those, and I'm going to talk about the stories behind each of those campaigns or those slogans.
How did you get involved with the work of Amnesty in the first instance?
The most joyous route you can imagine. I've been a trade union activist all of my adult life. 10 years as a rank and file shop steward and organiser. 5 years in the headquarters of Britain's biggest union at the time, the Transport and General Workers Union, where I did research and policy stuff. And then I had the privilege to work in the international trade union movement for 10 years, representing 1 million aviation workers in 120 countries. After 25 years of that trade union experience, but given the pace of travel that was involved in the job, I decided that I needed to do something that was a little bit more grounded here at home. And this opportunity at Amnesty came up, and it's just the most unbelievably serendipitous chance for me, because it marries my trade union experience, my commitment to the labour movement, with an ability to engage our activists in the whole range of human rights concerns which Amnesty has. So it's going extremely well. It's the 30th anniversary of our trade union network this year, and we've got a lot to celebrate, but there are a huge number of challenges ahead.
And how does it make you feel to be able to kind of do the work that you do and realise that those ambitions are not just for yourself, but for everybody else?
Well, I feel, first of all, a sense of immense privilege, also a sense of personal pride. There's also, for me, a sense of accomplishment in the work that we're doing, because the relationship between Amnesty and the labour movement is very strong and very, very solid at the moment. But I constantly remember and am reminded by those individuals at risk or those prisoners of conscience who are in the path of danger, just how difficult it is, the struggles that they're going through to ensure and guarantee the fundamental liberties that we all deserve and that some of us are able to enjoy. And my encouragement constantly comes from them. Last night I had the privilege of being with Wellington Chibebe, who's the president of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. Less than 2 years ago, he and his colleague Lovemore Mutombo were badly beaten up and incarcerated by the police in Zimbabwe and were issued with gagging orders simply because on a May Day rally they'd spoken out for workers' rights and for democratic rights for the people of Zimbabwe. We came to their defence then, and it was indeed a privilege to be with Wellington last night and to hear from him direct about his experiences. These are the brave people, these are the people who put themselves in harm's way for the sake of solidarity, for the sake of human decency, for the sake of justice. So the least I can do is stand for an hour on the plinth and remind myself and ourselves of the struggles that these people go through.
What other interests do you have? What do you get up to in your spare time?
Well, as I put on my little blog post about myself, if I hadn't been agitating for Amnesty International, I would have been calling for governments to take action to defend the vulnerable and vital flyways that migratory birds depend on. I'm a lifelong bird watcher. I have a passion for birds. I've just come from a really important international conference on shorebird conservation. And I'm concerned about the future of the spoonbill sandpiper and the slender-billed curlew, both of which are critically endangered, and both of whom have been put at risk as a result of overdevelopment, either in their wintering grounds, their breeding grounds, or on their crucial stopover sites. So when I'm not agitating and when I'm not involved in arts and culture, I like to be out bird watching, and that can be in all weathers and in all conditions. Rainforests, the Arctic, deserts, anywhere like that, I'd be happy to be. So yes, if I wasn't up there arguing for amnesty, I'd be advocating for spoonbill sandpipers and slenderbill curlews.
Great. How would you describe yourself as a person?
Outgoing, chirpy, thoughtful, probably fairly critical, mostly of myself, but also of the world around me. Content certainly would be part of it. Lovely backstory. I grew up in fascist Spain. I'm a gay man, and I came out at a particular period in the late 70s when it could be difficult to be gay openly. I've had to endure the struggles of HIV and AIDS, which hit my community extremely badly. I've been a lifelong trade unionist, and that's got me into trouble once or twice. Never with the law, I might add, but some employers haven't behaved as they should have done. So all of those experiences make human rights for me something that's just part of my being, part of my culture. It's more an attitude to the world rather than anything else. So as well as critical, I'd add the words caring, and with constantly a spirit of solidarity. The third word that I chose out of the three that I was allowed to choose for my descriptor on your webpage, the third word I choose is, alongside critical and caring, was cuddly, because deep down I'm a pretty affectionate sort of guy.
And Kelly, you mentioned growing up in Spain. Can you talk about the differences of, you know, as you've grown up, the differences in context that you've experienced and how that's affected you?
Well, it was actually, coming to the UK was quite a big culture shock. I didn't come to the UK till I was 14. Franco was still alive in Spain, so Spain was still under a dictatorship. That had a profound effect on me. As an expatriate living in a hippie colony in Ibiza in the 60s and then in Barcelona in the 70s, I was probably more protected from the dangers associated with resisting the Franco dictatorship than others were. But I loved Spanish culture, I loved the outgoing nature of the people, I loved the expressiveness, I loved the food, I loved the sunshine, I loved the warmth of the country. So when I came to Britain at the age of 14, it was a bit of a shock for me. I'll be frank, you know, the skies were grey, people were inexpressive, the food was not what I had expected. And I went to school, a comprehensive school, with a great deal of enthusiasm for learning, because I hadn't had many schooling opportunities in Spain. And that in turn brought me into conflict perhaps with some of my peers, 14-year-old boys who thought it was cool not to be interested in school, and who thought that I and my twin brother were teachers' pets for enjoying school. So that got us into some trouble. And we were 14-year-old pacifists, so it meant that any troublemaker in the school would come over and try to give us a wallop. But we kept at it, we persevered, and we had a fantastic time.
And you mentioned you have a twin brother as well.
We're identical twins, and we're very close. An example of just how the minds of twins work. A week or so ago, my twin lives in Manchester. A week or so ago, I had 20 minutes spare. I was in Soho, I had 20 minutes spare before an appointment. So I thought, what shall I do? Oh, I'll go to Foyles and I'll browse the bookcases. Just as I'm reaching the door of Foyles, who should I bump into by pure coincidence out of the 16 million or however many million people are in the Greater London area, but my twin brother, who was down for the day on business. And he had decided, he had 20 minutes spare before he had to catch his train back, and he had decided to pop into Foyles to browse the bookcases. So there we were, two twin brothers, bumping into each other by accident in this cosmopolitan city, but both at the back of our minds having made the same decision about what we were going to do with 20 spare minutes. So I think there's that telepathy somewhere between twins. I love him a great deal, and my nephew and my niece, and his wife.
And what other things would you say are important to you at this point in your life?
Security is very important. We live in troubled times. I'm lucky enough to have security at the moment. So that's something that I treasure. Friendships, love, the most important things in the world. The capacity to stretch myself intellectually. I did a master's a couple of years ago in a subject that had nothing to do with my work, and I got an extraordinarily good result, and I was completely agog with the opportunity to spend 4 months researching something that I was interested in. And I did the master's in arts criticism, and I researched the work of an American conceptual artist called Felix Gonzalez Torres, who died in 1996. And it was one of those extraordinary situations where I started curious about the work, and 5 months after doing the research, 5 months into the research, and when I was writing up the results, I was even more in love with the work and even more curious, and that's a unique privilege. So I like to keep myself stretched intellectually. At the moment, I've been lucky enough to have been selected by Amnesty International to participate in a very high-powered 10-week course on human rights law and practice at the London School of Economics, and it's pretty highbrow stuff, it's pretty intense, but I love it.
Great. So going back to the project, how does it feel to be one of 2,400 people that get to experience and get to explore the Anthony's piece?
Well, it's an extraordinary privilege. I think the piece as a piece of art is in itself fascinating and has its own integrity and coherence. And I've enjoyed the work from the outset, from conception right through to actually looking from below at some of the plinthers. But the actual opportunity to be on that plinth, to have the particular perspective that comes from being on that platform, from being one of the 2,400 people selected, feels really special. We'll see how it works out. I'd hope to do quite a lot of chanting. I'm not sure I'm going to have a lot of backing vocals to help me out, so I may not in the end do that. And as you can probably hear now, my voice is getting a little bit hoarse even before we started. But yes, I'm really, really looking forward to being part of this project. And it's one of those things that I can bounce my nephew and my niece on my knees, or getting a little bit old for that now, and say, yes, Shane was a plinther.
How are you feeling 20 minutes, 25 minutes before you go up on that plinth?
I don't want to faff my lines in terms of the human rights case that I want to put across, but I don't want to be boring or pedantic either. I think the key is just to be myself and to recognise myself. I mean, that's what the whole project's about, and that's the freedom that I'm going to be able to enjoy on the plinth. So if I faff it, my mates will laugh. If I don't faff it, my mates will laugh. So yeah, I'm just going to chill out and enjoy my hour.
And would you like to say anything else for the record as part of being part of the project, or you know, being here in 2009?
Well, I think the most important part of the project, in my view, is the way in which it's recording a part of Britain, a part of people's lived experience. All too often in the world, the only people that get voices are the powerful or the prominent. I'm not powerful. I'm lucky that Amnesty is fairly powerful. I do have perhaps the privilege of being prominent in my job, but many, many of the people who have been on that plinth have never had an opportunity to have their, not their 15 minutes of fame, but their 1 hour of glory. And that's very important. And I think what's particularly important about the plinth is that the way people have used that is entirely personal. So what will come out from the project for me is not simply the 4 months of 2,400 contributions, but more importantly, the mosaic, the tapestry, the interwoven narratives, the curiosities, the vanities, the flirtatiousness, all of those things that are part of human nature and will have been expressed in different ways by people lucky enough like myself to get up there.
Great, thank you very much.